Hello, and welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage, where we talk about the wreckage. And by this, I mean the ship of socialism that has hit a rock of sectarianism yet again.
And the ship of fools.
And splintered into whatever the fuck is happening right now.
It's more and more diving into the wreckage is becoming like a collaboration between Varn Vlog and Antifada. Because we have Andy tonight. Andy, of course, as everybody knows, you guys have all been Andy fans, like Varn and I, for many years.
Now. Andy's.
Inveterate trot spotter. So Andy is really good here because, I don't know, we all read a lot of stuff for this, but one question maybe we could ask ourselves in the course of discussing sex and degeneration is neo-Stalinism, right? Like this new Marxism-Leninism, does it deserve the trot spotting treatment? Are we going to see like all kinds of crack-ups and splits and breaks? Only a true connoisseur like Andy will be able to know the difference between the American Communist Party and the PSL and the Danny Schalls or the Dan Cohens and the World Can't Wait and the SCP or those trots.
I did a lot of research into like Latin American Trotskyism for the book that I wrote, and that was a few years ago. So I'm still kind of spotty on, you know, that knowledge has somewhat faded away. And yeah, in terms of like stuff in the U.S. and Europe, I know some basic stuff, so I wouldn't call myself an expert on, you know, every little sect. But I will say that the idea that Trotskyists are unique in their splitting and sectarianism and cultishness, maybe that was true in the 30s and 40s and 50s, but Stalinism is the same way today. I don't really see the difference. There's hardly even a political difference.
Yeah. I would go further than that. I mean, one, I am kind of an expert in American Trotskyism. And two, Maoism has broken up. I mean, in the 70s, the Maoist parties, there were about 70 of them, if Max Elbaum is to be believed. And they split up into three broad separate tendencies, which are completely unrelated to socialism with Chinese characteristics, which is MLM, Mao Zedong thought, Marxist-Leninism, Third Worldism, which itself split into classical Third Worldism and Marxist Internationalist Maoism, which itself also split into like a bunch of little sectlets by the 90s.
They created a lot of good film reviews before they went out. That's what I remember MIM for, is their film and music reviews.
Sure. It's a classic Shrek review.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
From a Marxist international perspective.
Well, they had cool names like Monkey Smashes Heaven and Leading Lights Communist Organization, which is apparently still around.
Is the Cosima Project still around? Because there's
Larry
Mount. No. Okay.
They came out of... they broke with the RCP Avakianite.
Where would Avakian land? Where would the RCP land in your typology of Maoists?
They're, I believe that they're classical Mao Zedong thought people, but they may be Marxist-Leninist Maoist. I don't know. They started as classical Mao Zedong thought, but I don't know where they ended up.
Their heyday was in the 2000s when they came out with the New American Constitution.
No, their heyday was in the 70s.
Late 60s? It was in the 70s.
I remember them from the aughts. They came out with a New American Constitution.
They almost took over the SDS, dude. Like...
RCP was like really, you know, not... They were a player in the late 60s, and they you know, in some debates that I've read, like, for example, at like an SDS conference, I think it was, between the Panthers, the Weathermen, and the RCP... RCP weren't the wrong party in that debate. They didn't always...
Did they come out of, like, the Bay Area Revolutionary Union movement or something?
Yeah,
like
they
that?
Did, which itself came out of the CPUSA when the CPUSA split, according to the Sino-Soviet split.
So they were real players back in the 70s. You're saying that my recollection of them having a New American Constitution in the aughts, that was just...
Vakian wasn't he wasn't a major player in the beginning.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Of the RCP. Yeah. When we talk about the RCP, I literally published the history on that party when I worked at Zero. So I kind of know it. But Avakian, I think, became a major player by the mid-70s. But like the Avakian in exile happened after one of their members was killed by a cop. When COINTELPRO was following them, COINTELPRO didn't actually target them the way they targeted the Panthers for like assassinations all that much, but they turned them over to local police once. And of course, the local police killed someone because that's what they do. And then Avakian went to France. And then they got weird. And the reason why they came back in the aughts and why you remember them for their new American Constitution, that's also when they finally changed their anti-LGBT stance.
Right. They were known as like the last of the chauvinists, the last of the socialist chauvinists. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, not anymore. Yes, for a while, they were the last one. And Kasama Project split from them because how long it took them to drop the anti-LGBT stuff. That's why Kasama split. One of the reasons. And Kasama died, I believe. They tried to do a go to the people, like base building, like union entryist thing in the early aught teens. And it like they quickly killed the Kasama Project. Like they like died within like 3 years of trying to do that. So, but yeah, we're dealing with some interesting things now. I mean, I think back to, I didn't ask you guys to read this, but Charlie Post, not always my favorite person, but a trot himself, at least he was.
Guest of the show, one of our early early guests that we had on years and years back.
He boycotts me for reasons that I don't entirely understand.
Very,
but I really
love him.
He predicted, interestingly, in his debates with Bhaskar Sankara in 2018, 2019, that the Jacobin attempt to do like a liquidationist into the DSA and then a popular front with the various Stalinist sects would actually make the Stalinist sects more popular when the Bernie campaign failed. And I was predicting in 2017 that we'd see the return of some kind of quote neo-Stalinism unquote, but I didn't actually figure it would be as historically illiterate as it is. Because how would you differentiate yourself from the DSA and still be in an organization, because the ultra left was kind of anti-organizational, and the RCP and not the RCP, the ICP, sorry, that's the International Communist or the Internationalist Communist Party. That's the Bordigas. They were splitting and stuff back then too. So where were you going to go? And I figured a lot of those people went from ultra left into the DSA. And if they moved from the DSA, they'd go to some incoherent Marxist-Leninist formation to differentiate themselves, even though we also saw the collapse of most of the classic Maoist parties in the end of the aught teens for neo-Dengism.
For example.
Well, I mean, the RCP still exists, but like the Maoist third worldists that exist today aren't these people who can trace themselves back to the MIM and the LLCO and that kind of
seems thing. That way. Yeah,
no, they're different. Their influence is more like Samir Amin and stuff like that. They're not actually people who believe that like the entire developed world is labor aristocracy that needs to be put in camps. And like,
wait, they're not advanced enough for that yet. They'll get there in a couple few years.
What's the tendency that Brett's a part of again? Brett from Rev Left.
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. I know that
I thought it was just a tendency in the CPUSA.
It was some kind of Maoist thing.
Well, I mean, there are very few pure MLs left.
Right.
Although there's a lot of people who claim it.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people who are like from other countries, Filipino or Nepali or Indian, and they grew up as a part of a Maoist party or a communist party from back home, and they bring it to the United States, and maybe they'll join something here or start something here or like be part of a group with other expats. Those exist. But in terms of like American Maoist parties, yeah, you got one of the Freedom Roads, right? And then a few things like that, like sects here and there that don't have a lot of nationwide coordination.
Arguably the PSL is a Maoist party, but they're also arguably a Trotskyist party.
The soft Maoism and the Trotskyism are pretty similar, like, standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, that was a case in Maiden. I have a book about it from the 80s. It argued that both all the Maoist sects and all the Trotskyist sects shared more similarities with each other than they often did with other Maoists and other Trotskyists, and that what they actually represented was a rejection of the formal communist parties that had historical ties to the Comintern, but that they really weren't, that they were all mostly student driven as opposed to the classical sects, which, like, that's a difference that Hal Draper pointed out in the 70s, is that there were classical sects in Marxism, and then there were socialist sects that were all Bonapartist in France before Marxism, but the student sects led to neo-Stalinism. But it's weird because I'm hesitant to use the term neo-Stalinist for them, Sean, because the neo-Stalinists of the 70s don't believe what these guys believe.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the idea of, like, Marxist-Leninist MMT thought are I believe in market socialism, I'm a Maoist, but I also believe in third periodism to eschew popular fronts, are these things, they weren't that incoherent in the 70s.
No, I mean, there was still whether you liked it or not, there was still, like, a guiding light, a guidepost, like a North Star, which was the Soviet Union and the Communist parties associated with it. So there was at least something to be, like, critical of and engage with in the negative. Nowadays, I feel like the neo-Stalinism is as much an aesthetic. You and I have tried to get at the whatever rationality exists, but it appears to be neo-Stalinism. It appears to be like cherry-picked quotes and events from history as a way to piss off the libs. Honestly,
yeah.
That's like the most coherence I could get out of it.
I mean, arguably the PSL is a fairly coherent formation, and the ACP.
What do they believe? What does the PSL believe?
Their former. Well, okay, so. They're Marxist-Leninist, but I've been told that they still actually believe in certain Trotskyist stuff, like permanent revolution, but they believe in a Marxist-Leninist form of it. I don't actually know that. I've never been in, and apparently you have to be pretty far in to get the, you know, those.
Like Scientology, you get the secret documents when you get to the 13th level.
But the PSL is pretty well-funded, but that's also because it has some pretty big names and one millionaire family in its organization and central committee. So, you know, so you got like some famous musicians, Jody Dean and the Becker family up in the PSL. But they split. They're split from the WWP, which is where Maupin, Caleb Maupin, was originally from. I said he was a leader. I've actually been told he wasn't. He was like their public face for a little while on RT, but I guess he wasn't actually like officially in the central committee or the executive board. But the WWP, that's Sam Marcy's party that split with the other Trotskyist over supporting the Soviets in the Prague Spring and the Hungarian insurrection. So, you know, there's that. There's also, I mean, it's hard to say because, like, there's also a lot of, like, neo-Stalinists who, like, clung around, like, the gray zone. But, like, arguably, the gray zone is not even Marxist. Like, they're just, you know.
Just anti-imperialist.
Right.
It more and more it becomes possible to be non-Marxist, even non-socialist, and simply anti-imperialist. I feel like that's one of the other great, you know, guiding lights of this neo-Stalinism, too, is, like, dare we call it a vulgar anti-imperialism, certainly an anti-Americanism, right? Which it seems to be the core of it. So trying to relitigate the Cold War without an actual Cold War.
But it's also interesting where it's gone. Like, there is a way that some of this neo-Stalinist stuff has moved from Jay Sakai adjacent and Gerald Horn adjacent positions to Browderism and stuff like that you saw, like bringing back up William Z. Foster and like American syndicalist Marxist-Leninism and stuff like that, that you saw Midwestern Marx do before they joined with InfraHaz's weird whatever to form the ACP.
But I'm now broken with them, right? As far as I could tell. This is like, for people who are like, why are we talking about sex and degeneration? This is like 15 minutes into the episode.
Have the Midwestern Marxists broken with the ACP?
This is the...
Not according to those Danny Shaw pieces.
No, not according to the Danny Shaw thing. They have not at all.
Oh, okay.
But yes,
yeah. To keep up with
Sean, tell us what this episode's about, because I'm a little lost too.
Okay, well, the point of this episode was like, we have this wealth of knowledge between Varn and Andy of both two flavors of Leninism, Trotskyism, and I guess Maoism, Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, whatever you want to call it. There appears to be a resurgence of this, but also at the same time, a lot of the weird foibles that we saw in the 70s and 80s are returning. A lot of the processes of like generation and degeneration are returning. There's happening way faster. New sects and new quote unquote parties come together and break up within 6 months. This is continuing, I think, this process that Varn and I have been discussing for several years now, which is like the continued degeneration of the left post the Bernie moment, right? So today, behind the paywall, we're going to talk a bunch about the crack up at the ACP and this Danny Shaw fella. But in the first half of things, I think we want to kind of lay the groundwork for understanding what, say, Hal Draper's Anatomy of the Microsect says about this tendency or said about this tendency in the 1970s, why we haven't been able to move past it, what the difference between a sect and a party might be, how we might imagine that. That's my attempt at kind of bracketing this episode. What do you think, Derek?
I'm pretty doomy. And I am at the point where I think we should just declare that the current left is not dead because another sect actually claims that. but it's dissolved. And I actually don't think it's actually dead, but has dissolved into an incoherent pile of goop that has no discipline at all other than sectarian formations. And I would include in that, by the way, the fact that a sectarian whole civil war has been going on in the DSA now for 3 years. So to get into, what I saw with this going back into the microsect thing, I was writing a book on this topic and I've recently abandoned it to write a book on a more depressing topic because that's where my mind is lately. But, I was mapping out the rise and fall of the new left into the new communist movement, and then that's liquidation in the 1980s. And the reason why I kind of dropped the book is I realized that, like, it's really hard to get all the research without just over-relying on about 5 sources, because there's just not a lot of good sources. The sectarian milieus did not keep good records, and they often hid their records because they pretended to be clandestine organizations, and some of them, like the Weathermen, were. So it's very hard to get a good feel for where this all ended up. But let me sketch in brief what I saw from studying the 60s, and then I'll turn it back over to you guys. In the late 50s, the American socialist and communist movement was more or less dead. The American socialist movement actually sided with the Red Scare, going to try to purge Bolsheviks and communists during the 50s. And for a variety of reasons, starting in 1948, the American Communist Party went from like 80,000 members, which was its high point, to about 5,000 members in less than 10 years. And the members of that party were in generally richer and older than a lot of the rest of the socialist movement at the time. So by the time you get to the 1960s, the only people really hanging about are people who could like go to Europe and come back, or who could be independently wealthy if they got flushed out in a Center for Un-American Activities investigation or something like that. And the Center for Un-American Activities had focused on the bastions of communism that are still our bastions of communism today, which is New York and California, because that was the high watermark of the CPUSA in the Popular Front period was in New York and California. Now, its origins, interestingly, it was actually initially more popular in the Southeast and in the Midwest. People who've read Hammer and Hoe know about Alabama, but also the upper Midwest. There was a good bit of CPUSA overlap with the end of the sewer socialist and a lot of those people who fled to Canada. But by the time you get to the end of the war, they're overwhelmingly concentrated in New York and California, and they get purged in the various state and then national level purges of communists. Like, we don't kill them, but they can't get jobs. You know, a lot of them flee to Europe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Weirdly, the Midwest was not really hit as hard by the Red Scare. I don't really know why. Like, they just weren't. So in Minnesota and whatnot, you saw still a lot of not so much Marxist-Leninist or anything like that, or Trotskyist even, but a lot of like Marxist-adjacent, Marx-friendly professors like Stoughton Lind and C. Wright Mills and those kind of people. And they started working with some early split-offs from Marxism and some Marxists who were still tied to the CPUSA and the Black community on the civil rights movement. Then when opposition to the Vietnam War finally hit the universities, which it did kind of late. One of the other things I learned is like the anti-war movement was more student driven than labor driven, but that the opposition to the Vietnam War was actually higher amongst Korean veterans of the Korean War and working class people, because they were far more likely to get drafted than they were amongst students or the leadership of the labor movement, which is very interesting. And a lot of the reason why the leadership of the labor movement wasn't opposed to it is they were getting contracts from the government. So that led to this big focus on civil rights adjacent college activism, which also you had all these college students who'd actually come out of the working class legitimately and come up into school during the GI Bill periods from the late 40s into the 60s. And you get your first rave around that. As that starts to die, the Sino-Soviet split caused all these groups to split off the CPUSA. We mentioned like the Revolutionary Union Movement, some of the Panthers. But there's also all kinds of other internal events really, really messing with this, because you start having like tensions over Cambodia and Vietnam by the end of the 60s. So people who are like pro Pol Pot versus people who are pro Mao versus people who are pro Ho Chi Minh. And then the liberal part of the SDS movement kind of dissolves and leaves. And for whatever reason, Trotskyists become the last men standing in a lot of this stuff. And they have been kind of out of the picture for a long time, partly because of their position in World War II. Because a lot of the Trotskyists did not support the U.S. entering World War II, which is something that they don't like to talk about. So you have that milieu, right? Harrington and co, Harrington of DSA fame, is being mentored by Max Shackman of Advisor to Neoconservatives fame in the SPA. The SPA is dissolved at the end of the 60s. And that means you have all kinds of people coming out of that and all kinds of people coming out of these splits from the CPUSA, which had done a lot of entryism into the Students for Democratic Society, most famously the RCP, the Weathermen, the Yippies, groups like that. And they start picking up on their own various different tendencies of ideological positions based off of where you stood in the Sino-Soviet split. This is one of the things that makes me so mad about this current Western Marxism thing. It's because it doesn't deal with the fact that a lot of this was actually responding not to like CIA operatives or whatever the fuck was going on at Saban. It was about the way Americans and Latin Americans were responding to the Sino-Soviet split and to the breakup of a lot of the official communist parties, not just in France or in Italy, but also like Chile and Latin America, all over the place. I mean, and so this is going on. And then the SWP in the late 60s starts deciding they're going to support the Castro Revolution in Cuba, but not the others. And so that accelerates the sectarian breaks in the Trotskyists, too. So this is when the Trotskyist breaks go gangbusters, and there's a ton in America. So and basically this happens. You have all these splits around Maoism. You have all these splits around Marxist-Leninism. There's these tons of parties in the 70s. Max Elbaum books Revolution in the Air is about this. Heavy Radicals is a book that's a history of the RCP and COINTELPRO. You can read any history of the Panthers and get a lot of the stuff too. But one of the interesting things you see about these groups is most of them are less than 5,000 people. Max Elbaum estimates from these groups that if you took all 60 or 70 of them together, there would have been a million communists in the United States and a population of about 250 million at the time. So that's actually a lot. It's way more than even the historical high point. But they were so busy fighting each other that it didn't matter.
Well,
most of them are gone.
It's important. So, you know, when I think of the left in the late 60s, I think of the word movement, capital M movement. And these sects were a part of this capital M movement. A lot of them were part of SDS. A lot of them were part of rank and file groups or different Leninist sects or the communist parties or whatever. But there was, you could speak of a movement and then the left. 1970 rolls around. It starts to fall apart so badly, and the reaction to it from the so-called silent majority is so strong that I actually, there's an article about, I think it was in 71, they tried to surround the White House and, like, force Nixon to get on the phone with Vietnam. Do you know this story? They had this plan to have, like, a people's tribunal of Nixon or something, and they had contacts with Vietnam, and they called them and said, please don't do this. You're embarrassing us. So you got to the point where Vietnam itself was telling the movement, stop, please. This is not good. And things fragment from there into these sects, new communist movements, new religious movements, parapsychological cults, which, you know, this is what happens when this high point, this optimistic point of revolution fades away, and you go into a situation of defeat where the only people either, you know, move on with their lives. This is the same story as the 50s, right? Like the Popular Front, the communists come out of the war feeling pretty good. There's a huge strike wave. People like Stalin. You know, all these communists are writing for newspapers and Hollywood and in the government. But then there's this major grassroots reaction to communism that is, you know, goes hand in hand with McCarthyism, the Peekskill riots, for example. And throughout the 50s, you just get people leaving the Communist Party, you know, moving on with their lives. So this is what happens in the 70s. And I think that's kind of where we are now in the post-Bernie movement, is we had something that we could say was a left in 2016, 2017, maybe even the entire 2010s. And now when you, well, you know, if you, you know, if you have a coworker who wants to get involved in the left, you know, where do you tell them to go? There's a couple groups you can say, check them out. Maybe you'll like them, but they're not very, there's nothing a lot of inspiring going on.
So I think it's interesting if you were like to do a history of our time versus a history of the last cycle, because I do think that we're kind of in a cycle where we had a period where like nobody was a fucking socialist. Like, you might have been an anarchist, but that was also super vague. The anarchist movement in the 90s didn't have a lot of historical connections to the socialist anarchist movements of the, you know, before the 1950s. There wasn't a whole lot of knowledge about it either. I mean, like, the anarchist movement were basically represented by Gen X weirdos in the bioregionalism and primitivist community.
And Noam Chomsky's anarcho-liberalism.
Well, I was about to get to that. And anarcho-liberalism, which was the most common, which because Trotsky is like a point of continuation between these. But Trotsky's old enough, he's a point of continuation between all these movements, actually, weirdly. And then you also had like Bookchinitism, which was pretty common, but itself was like a new left phenomenon. Bookchin was part of, you know, had some relationships to like the Situationists, but rejected their Marxism and then became like this eco socialist anarchist, and then eventually this eco-municipalist. There is a point of connection between us and them that's direct. And that is, it was the leftovers of the late New Left / late New Communist movement that actually formed the leadership in America of a lot of the groups that emerged after Occupy fail and the anarchists kind of stepped out of the way. And that's not just true with like social Democrats. It's also true with like the ultra left. Like there's, you know, there's a lot of like ultra left groups in the 70s that kind of were dormant for like 20 years. Guilds of AN communization, for example, came back in the early aughtteens. And it was for a brief period after Occupy, and it was very clear that like the Adbuster style anarchists failed. It seemed like it was wide open for what was going to replace it. And what happened, it's kind of interesting because if you look at the 90s, who are your left? Well, I mentioned the anarchists. The other left that was really around were British imported Trotskyists. The American Trotskyist movement as we knew it.
ISO.
I didn't knew it. Yeah.
Talking about Tariq Ali and Christopher Hitchens and this sort.
Yeah. Well, the ISO was popular because of the popularity of the British SWP. The American movements, by and large, were dead, with the exception of like the most extreme ones like the Spartacus League. And Spartacus leaves spurs like the International Bolshevik Tendencies. But these were all tiny groups. The SWP, the U.S. one, was basically around to run Pathfinder magazine and Pathfinder publications, and that was it. Now, I guess they still are around, but they're like in their 90s now. And the ISO came back with a vengeance, but the ISO... I mean, it's the ISO's history is weird because there's a relationship to the independent socialist committees, but they get absorbed by Cliffite British Trotskyists who are related to the IS tradition.
International and, Socialist Committees is Hal Draper, right?
Independent.
The Independent Socialist Committees.
Yeah, my bad.
And some of them split off and join with the Cliffite tendency to form the American ISO.
Okay.
Yes.
So would this be a good time to talk about Draper's article? And
Let's talk about Draper because Draper
was
president.
Yeah, tell us a bit about Draper. I think we're all familiar with his work here broadly, but who was Draper? What did he stand for? Where did he fit in with this mix? And then we'll talk about anatomy of the microsect.
All right.
Yeah, give us a background on Draper, then I'll talk about the text a little bit.
Well, Draper's an interesting fellow because he's tied into the Max Shackman split from the SWP all the way back in the 30s. His brother was in the American Communist Party. They were still kind of close. He was really important in the free speech movement in Berkeley, where he was a librarian.
He mentored Mario Sava.
He did all kinds of stuff.
The body upon the gears guy. Yeah. People don't know who that is.
Go ahead.
Yeah. My impression of him was he kind of went through the ringer between the 30s and the 60s, the Trotskyist ringer. And by the time he's in the 60s, he's kind of like many of us, you know, still a militant, but sort of without a home. I don't know what group he was a part of at that point in the late 60s, but he began to be drawn into a rejection of the way the Leninist left had become aligned with various states. And so he begins to develop this concept of the third camp, which is a very new left kind of reappraisal of the Leninist tradition, where you're no longer interested in supporting the capitalist states, as some of the Trotskyists have started doing, certainly not interested in supporting the Stalinist states and parties, but are now interested in the workers and struggle. A position James came to 10 years before or more. Understandable why he had this influence on the new left. And so this text that he wrote, Anatomy of a Microsect in 1973, is sort of, I feel like, a message to young leftists then and now. Maybe I'll just read the first paragraph of the first section, The Road Forward. A socialist movement will become a possibility in this country, as it did in others, as its bases are matured by socio-political conditions. If, however, it cannot be created simply by an effort of will, it is also historically true that it is not simply a matter of spontaneous generation. When the bases of a socialist movement mature, it will become difficult for it to come into being unless the nascent movement is crystallized with the help of active socialist elements. Every socialist movement has been the outcome of a fusion of spontaneity and leadership, of naturally developed elements, and conscious organization. The first line of it says, since there are socialists in America, but no socialist movement, it is understandable that the socialists will say, let us go and form a socialist movement. And so this is, you know, a critique of a mode of leftist thought that still exists, which is like, there's no socialist movement. We've read enough history. We've read enough Lenin or whoever we like to make the blueprints for it. All we got to do is use these blueprints and make the small party, or like the sect becomes a party. The party becomes a small mass party. The small mass party becomes a massive mass party. And that's all you got to do. We have the ideas. And he's saying, well, no, it's not only is the moment not right, which is the first paragraph I read, not only is America too backwards for this model to work, but also the way you're thinking about starting this stuff is not actually what Lenin suggested. And this type of sectarian thinking leads to the same cul-de-sacs over and over again. And throughout the essay, he describes these cul-de-sacs and then offers a solution at the end.
Although I think a solution is interesting, because I think a solution actually is given to degenerating into sex itself, which he kind of actually hints at. But he didn't live in a time where like this kind of publishing stuff could have such clear parasocial attachment, because he's talking mostly about newspapers and the written word. He's not talking about people running radio shows or television shows or anything like that, because socialists would have been shut out of the media at this time. Like, there's no way they're getting on the radio in any significant amount, are on television after the 70s.
Well, I think he's talking about the newspaper in the same way that Lenin talks about it, right? Which is that it's a newspaper, but it's also about organizing yourself. You're not simply putting out a publication of your ideas. You're bringing people together to figure out what those ideas are and to go through the process of editing it, printing it, and distributing it, which helps you organize ideologically and practically.
What's interesting is he also says that the sects do this same thing, and that if you're smart, you can actually even use sectarian literature yourself. But dear God, don't join those sects. Like, basically, like, you can read this stuff and it might even help you, but do not join them, because you'll be under their you're submitting to their disciplinary apparatus, and it's going to be a disaster. And then the other thing he points out, he talks about two ways to handle the sects, which is the non-sectarian sect and then the clearinghouse of the sects. He doesn't call them that, but like, he's actually describing the beginnings of the groups that were going to become the DSA explicitly, the New American Movement and the survivors of the end of the SPA. And I literally do think he's talking about Harrington and one of them. And then the other, he's describing people who's like, oh, well, we'll just all form a popular front or a united front of sectarian organizations. But he's like, if there's no movement to make you stay together, the different programs, which are all ideologically based programs, even if they're democratically formed by small groups of people, because these are tiny parties, they're going to come up in direct opposition to each other in ways that you can't undo unless there is a big movement which forces you to work together and get past these things in the first place. And he actually talks about that in the terms of the early Bolsheviks, like the older Bolsheviks were like that.
Let me read a paragraph on that, because I think he puts that. So this is jumping to the end where he's giving his sort of suggestions on what to do. As long as the life of the organization, whether or not labeled a party, is actually based on its politically distinctive ideas, rather than on the real social struggles in which it is engaged, it will not be possible to suppress the clash of programs requiring different actions in support of different forces. The key question becomes the achievement of a mass base, which is not just a numerical matter, but a matter of class representation. Given a mass base in the social struggle, the party does not necessarily have to suppress the internal play of political conflict, since the centrifugal force of political disagreements is counterbalanced by the centripetal pressure of the class struggle. And one other really great quote from Marx and Engels that he mentions before that: to move a fighting sector of the class into action against the established powers by only a step is more important than 1,000 programs, Marx and Engels used to reiterate, and there's no use denouncing them for deprecating programmatic politics. To the sect mind, this approach is utterly incomprehensible. So the program is, we're supporting the class moving towards conflict with the establishment, and that's where our politics come from. And we can have our whatever politics we want before that, but that is not our task, is not to force this program onto the workers. And yeah, I think that's well said, well put. And I think the most successful groups understand this.
Yeah, it's I think that's a good summation. It's interesting that this is 1973 that it's written in, right? So obviously Draper and company, and if I recall correctly, there's a direct line from Draper to Teamsters for a Democratic Union, right? Like, I believe that he sends college students from the Bay Area out east to organize in the Midwest under the Teamsters, and they end up forming this socialist group, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which famously, you know, is a huge player today in the Teamsters. But anyways, it's interesting that we get this text from in 1973. At the very, very tail end, like the beginning of the end of the Fordist period and the rise of neoliberalism, and a transition in the 1970s typified by stagflation and also a huge wave of wildcat strike in the United States and in Western Europe. But yet nobody, not Hal Draper's people, nor the Maoists, nor anybody, was able to take the lesson and intervene or take that energy from the social basis, as he says, and turn it towards socialism. Instead, it turns towards, as we know, atomization, going a long way towards, you know, explaining why by the time the 1980s comes, you just have this million man milieu of individual. So
his answer is the America is too backwards for this.
Yeah, which is useless, actually, as an essay.
Well,
why is America?
Well, what's the?
Because it doesn't do what you want.
Sure, but what's the counter?
So much.
The response to that is like, well, we're not trying hard enough, or we're not trying the right idea.
It's actually more simple and more economic than that. We were in a moment of very, very shitty economic conditions, but not high unemployment. The prior period of leftist coalitions around the movement was a period of high unemployment.
And the theorization as well of what the precipitating event was going to be that was going to take these sects or these parties from small bodies into larger ones, into mass parties. It was meant to be a 1929 style crisis. Instead, it's not quite that, right? 1970s is not that. It is a crisis, but a different one. It exhibits itself a different way.
I mean, he's also, I mean, there's some other interesting things in here. The American socialist movement during the period that we're talking about, because initially it's responding negatively to Fordism, is actually super critical of labor bureaucracy. But then it accuses basically the entire labor union movement of just being the same as the labor bureaucracy within the upper echelons of the unions. And it took forever to that to be reversed. I mean, if you go back and listen, like, or read stuff from the early 60s, like no one thinks that you can do the go into the workers' movement and revive it. I mean, but the America is a backwards country thing has been used by everybody. I mean, Jay Sakai has the same belief, blah, 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 blah. The problem is, what makes it backwards?
Certainly it's backward vis-a-vis Europe. Right, because
I don't think so. I actually think Europe's a shithole.
No, I know, but I'm trying to get myself in Leninist headspace, right? So, like, it's backwards in terms of it doesn't have a Soviet-oriented communist party. It doesn't have...
But it does. I mean, bureaucracy. Like, we have a Soviet-oriented communist party in the 1970s.
In the 60s, there were a lot of tendencies that thought the fact that it didn't have that party was actually a sign that the U.S. was more advanced. Facing reality, for example, or the sort of James tendency, always had this position that the American worker was always going to lead the international revolution, and that American, in this weird way, was there's an Engels quote in a letter to Marx where he's like, "Yeah, the United States isn't the United States proletariat is not looking too good right now, but one day they're going to make the entire world quake with." The strength of their proletarian movement. And James thought that was what was happening in the 30s. And so there was still this belief, and that Watts riot from the Situationists you mentioned is part of that, that the U.S. proletariat, although it was lacking in the mass parties, kind of just molecularly was more advanced in this way because... this genetic way, because the United States was sort of founded as this rebellion against the old world, and like that process was still in motion. But I guess Draper didn't really think that. He was too
late. No, and although Draper does it, what's interesting about this is what he seems to say is backwards is actually the, he would almost like he's talking about the way people talk about the PMC today, but he doesn't use that. And that term already existed by the time he's writing this, by the way. We need to like Aaron Reich's already written their book. So why is it that this is going the way it's going? Because I have thought about this a lot. Like, why is America so backwards? It's not economically backwards. Socially, until the 1950s, if you were going to pick a place that was more progressive, you would have picked the States over most of Europe. That changes in the 1950s. And then if you think about what the CFs were doing, the communist parties like in France and Italy were doing in the 60s and 70s, they were pivoting to the right of a lot of the socialist parties. So that also can't be it. So, like, what makes it backwards? Well, the racial tensions is one thing, and that's, I think Draper's got that in mind. But that can't explain all of it, because he's also, like, one of the things here is, like, making fun of the fact that everyone was looking for a new revolutionary subject in the 60s, including C.L.R. James. That's the James you're mentioning,
though. Yeah.
He's like, no, we have to go back to the workers and try to like work through the official union movement, but in a combat position. Battle the internal bureaucracy.
He believes that when the workers are in struggle, even reformist struggle, even bread and butter struggles, there is a confrontation with the establishment, and it's the role of militants to serve as an educational force as they intervene and support those struggles. So he didn't think the conflict was lacking necessarily, or that it would always be lacking, but that the sort of consciousness of their conflict was with the bourgeoisie was what was lacking.
So, I mean, I find it interesting. I also find it interesting that Draper's tendency, once he leaves the Independent Socialist committees and just kind of goes off by himself to write for various publications. I mean, by the late 70s, most of his publications are with Monthly Review of all places, which is interesting to think about because he's pretty critical of Monthly Review.
He shouted them out in this piece. He's like, yeah, the Sweezy's Monthly Review is pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good, although he also calls it neo-Stalinist.
Yeah, yeah. But this is like to his credit, though, because what he's calling for at the end is the establishment of political centers, which is how he describes Iskra and the early Bolsheviks, and a political sector where there can be people of many different tendencies, but the sectarianism does not exist. It's not about sects forming a united front. It's about an organization where we can figure out what our politics are, not drawn on of lines of group hustles, but on actually what you politically think and what you politically argue and what you want to do. And that's where the debate happens. It's not between the Trotskyists and the Stalinists and the Leninists, but it's actually like, okay, here's a worker struggle. We want to intervene. What's our position on how to intervene or what the struggle is or how we qualify it? So just sort of getting back to a more tactical stance in supporting the proletarian struggle and also recognizing that you're not leading it. You've got a role to play, but you're not in charge.
Right. I mean, so this is, even though he's a Leninist, he seems to be somewhat hesitant of any vanguard party beyond the role of educator. And even then, he's like, you should be pulling from multiple programs and multiple units. And maybe you actually pull from several different political centers or Marxist centers to get your point across as you see fit, and then see how that goes for you. What's interesting is he doesn't try to spell out a way to get to the party, even though he does seem to think that's important. But I think he's like, we can't know how to do that right now. Like,
yeah,
because the other thing he says is Iskra is the best we got. But I also know that we're not going to repeat the Bolshevik experience in America because we just can't. Like, we're not in the same conditions.
And he says no sect. Every sect says that they're going to do it. But no sect has ever done it. Or like maybe the Bolsheviks were the only ones you could say. And that's even a much different story. So that, I mean, this is how I feel too. Like if people get into a certain thinker or a certain idea and want to start their own sect or something, like, you know, go for it. But this literally never works. And your activity as a leftist, as a militant, should not be about forwarding the thoughts of Mao or Trotsky or Lenin or Bakunin or whatever. Like, learn from that stuff, try to let it guide you in some way. But our goal is to support the proletariat in fighting. That's the most important thing. And what you, all the stuff you think kind of doesn't matter if you're not actually moving that forward. And this is this is a point that Danny Shaw makes in the pieces we'll be talking about
after paywall. Behind the paywall.
Yeah, but it's actually funny because I was actually reading, well, what do people say about this? So a lot of people love this piece, but it's also like, weirdly, the Trotskyists are the group, particularly the former IMT, the RCA, the most sectarian Trotskyists are the people who have the biggest problem with this essay because they feel called out, I guess.
Yeah, they are. They should be.
But I want to read this, the rut we're in, because I actually think this paragraph is actually seemingly what we tried to do to get out of the sects that emerged at the end of this era. And we're right back there. This is actually where I'm fascinated. Such is the road of the sect. We already read that or talked about it, but how do we get out of this rut? There are two notions that try to remedy the ills of sectism by broadening the sect. The intention is good, but the remedy impractical. One is the proposal to abolish sectarianism by a call for unity of all the sects. This is basically what the DSA has done, actually. This may also be present as a road to forming a socialist movement, but it is a piteous illusion. In practice, it may mean a spate of unity negotiations among some of the sects, a common time-killing enterprise.
Beautiful. I love
or
that.
Or even the unification, or two, a drop in the bucket. I mean, the ACP is one of those, by the way. But the actual unification of all the sects is an inherent impossibility, with a programmatic slivers on which all the sects are based are politically incompatible. See the DSA being totally incoherent right now because of this very position. The product of sect unification turns out to be nothing but a somewhat larger sect. As long as conditions for a genuine socialist movement do not obtain, the idea of an all-inclusive sect is a will-o'-wisp. Incompatible political programs can be held together, at least for a historical period, within the framework of a party or movement, for the cement which holds such a formation together is its role in the class struggle itself. So he's not saying that we would necessarily get out of sectism entirely in a socialist movement, but that is kind of irrelevant because the movement of the workers makes it a lot less, like, you just have to capitulate to masses in that situation.
Yep.
And
this is another thing that I constantly come back to when I'm talking to leftists today, is that you don't really know what you think. You don't really know what your politics are until you're in the struggle. I can't, yeah. You know, I've had multiple experiences where I've tried to organize with leftists, usually anarchists, but I think it's true of all leftists. When the time comes to organize and the sort of immediate tasks are clear and they're not interested in it because like they don't see their role as organizing their workplace or their building or apartment. They see their role as, you know, furthering the IWW agenda or the DSA agenda or what have you. It's always somewhere else.
Or whatever caucus there are in the DSA's agenda, are we at whatever.
Or like teaching people about, you know, your sept and your politics. And no, the task is to fight where you stand, organize where you stand. And if you're totally uninspired about your own life and the lives of people around you, go to the picket line, talk to the workers, ask what they want, ask what they need, ask what they think.
The second proposal is the one that aims at the same result, be a different route, launching a sect whose distinguishing programmatic point is that we'll voluntarily eschew all distinguishing programmatic points, which I'll admit I have tried to do. That's what the North Star was. This is achieved by limiting the program to some minimum socialist or radical basis so that everyone can agree. A statement of abstract socialism or like the minimum standard, which I do think you actually need, but it's not sufficient. Because you do have to be like, that person is not a socialist anymore. Like, there does have to be a line. But if a left wing wants to push a group to revolutionary position, like no support for Democrats, it's funny how that comes up over and over and over and over again. The minimum is exploded. In practice, therefore, a program must be reformist. This was what he's accusing the Socialist Party of America of doing, basically. The Socialist Party has wanted to be this kind of sect most of the time since it ceased to be a mass movement. And more recently, the New American Movement, which literally joined with the Democratic Socialist remnant that was left after Shachtman blew up the SPA, has set out to concretize this aim in some still unclear form. And we now know what that form was going to be, guys, because in the early 1980s, it becomes the DSA. Ironically, so the DSA, weirdly, is both of the things he's complaining about here.
And what he proposes. It's a political center, but it's a reformist political center because it's based around this idea of the left wing of the possible. And what he is, he's trying to get us to fight this concept of the possible suggesting that doesn't get us out of this problem, which is that. If you want to make a splash politically, you kind of need to be in the Democratic Party because that's where people look. That's what people think politics are.
Right. And if you want to break from that, you might do other weird shit like start tailing right wing parties because you still think the only way to be engaged in politics is to do this kind of shit.
Right. Because that's where where's the politics now? Not the Democratic Party. That's totally a spent force in this moment. So now
in a very real way, though, like the Democratic Party, both in the 70s and today, is like capacious enough to take up to like enjoin everybody to be a part of this larger process of like developing best practices, developing ideas on Tumblr, you know, that eventually work their way up, taking stuff from the academy and like. Talking about material conditions and throwing up graphs on twitter.com. Like that's all part of this process of like ideological and practical work that makes us all Democrats, right? At the end of the day, even like Marxist groups, even activist groups, even groups who claim to hate the Democrats, just by being activists, you're part of this larger sort of state project, party project, Democratic Party project to like, create and recreate the world by administering society through the state. So like there's a way in which you know the Democratic
flat.
Oh, do I? I'm sorry. Why I'm saying everyone's a Democrat?
Yes.
Well, I don't think it's just Democrats though, because it's also Republicans too. It's like a certain conception of relating to the state.
You know, the plats aren't too far off from this essay either, because there's a I think this part of this essay is like, look, if you meet someone who's in these sects, you gotta talk them out of it. You gotta blow these sects up, and that's part of our task right now, is to get people out of this sect thinking. And that's
the problem that I run into with this essay is that most of the political centers become sects themselves, even when they're aiming at destroying other sects. And I think when we talk about, like, no, you're right. Plat practice, like, we read this when I was in Platypus, like, you know. But the idea that we're all Democrats is both true, but like, okay, I'm gonna go like out Platypus to Platypus and quoting Adorno. Wrong life can't be lived rightly. You cannot escape being part of something that is recapitulated by NGOs and thus the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, because both sides like NGOs, if we're completely honest. The statification of civil society is a problem, but the idea that you can by will just stand outside of it because you know that it's a problem is itself an illusion. You can't. Like, there's no way to stop BLM from being recuperated after the riots are done. There's no R being grifted after the riots are done, too. There's no way to do that.
Uh-huh.
Right? The reason why there's no way to do it is because it's something that exists in a political moment. And if it cannot, you know, go into something new, it will be recapitulated in it. But the political moment still existed. What happens today, what I find really fascinating today, and Andy and I have talked about this before another time we came on, but like Occupy is something that everyone turns against and now was like, oh, we were all against it. Now BLM's become that way too. Or they're not even against it. They just don't want to fucking talk about it.
Really. Uh-huh.
Like
COVID. Nobody wants to talk about COVID. And
I mean, that is. Another way of thinking about this is Vincent Bevan's book about the 2010s, and then Jasper Burns' critique of it. And, you know, I like both Vincent Bevan's and Jasper Burns, but I think Burns makes a pretty good point in his critique that Bevan's is sort of saying, he reads Bevan's to be saying, like, well, if we only had a more like programmatic stance when we form these movements or like engage with them, they wouldn't be recuperated, they wouldn't go to the right and such and Burns is like, no, I mean, we're just not in, like, the moment was never ripe for that to happen. There were cases where people tried it in Brazil, for instance, and it, you know, it didn't fail because people didn't understand this critique that you're making. It failed because these struggles were always going to be limited by the conditions that they were struggling under, which doesn't really help us. But I think that's, you know, Burns has a argument that's closer to what Draper is trying to say. I'm not sure if Burns agrees with what Draper is trying to say, but yeah, I think there's a good refutation of Bevan's here in the Draper.
Maybe as a way of transitioning us towards like the paywall, we can historicize once more and talk about over the last 50 years or so, a lot of the sort of preconditions for this politics, the idea of like a class even in itself, let alone for itself, has shifted massively in the United States just in terms of the union density numbers, right? Hal Draper's fighting theorizing in a situation where, like, it was conceivable to imagine that the working class was, you know, some palpable thing, that struggles would happen, that a base broadly conceived could hook up with something real, a real movement. And I'm not certainly saying that logically that doesn't exist any longer, only pointing out that the problems that Draper points out are maybe even more damning for us today, 50-something years out, with a destruction of the really existing labor movement than they were in 1973.
Well, I mean, 73 is like the end of the high point of a manufacturing employment. I mean, that's when you start seeing manufacturing employment and the traditional union model really hit the wall. And immediately what makes up for the traditional union model are places that are still highly centralized, but not involved in production. And that is government work and government, you know, and it's actually around the Nixon era, I believe, where government unions are legalized. Because we have to remember, like, for most of the NCLB, actual government workers could not unionize. And there's still states where you can't effectively, which is why the, you know, which is why even the density of government union employment is still under 50% in every single sector.
Yeah, that goes back to FDR, right? The conception of early progressives was that you would essentially create interest groups within the government who would be bargaining against the taxpayer, essentially.
Right. So basically, and they also never imagined as many people working for the government that actually ends up happening under Fordism and neoliberalism. Which is something that's interesting to think about with FDR.
And with the civil service reform that we're looking at over the next 4 years.
Right. It's going to be interesting where this all goes. I can already tell you that, but 1979 was the all-time peak of manufacturing employment at I think it was 19.5 to 20 million people working in manufacturing in the United States, which is still not a lot when you consider that even at this time period, the population in the U.S. is over 200 million people. But today, the manufacturing is down to like 12%, 8% if you take out management. So that one of the things that's really interesting is from the Second International forward, and this is a Second International position, the focus is on the industrial proletariat and informal labor sectors. No, when Marx was alive, actually, like, most proletarian weren't even in formalized wage relations. You got paid, like, sometimes you got paid once every 3 years, and sometimes you got paid daily, depending on where you work. It's crazy when you look at the various pay schemes that happened in the 19th century. And there was no formal labor sector. There was not Social Security numbers. There was, like, it was basically the way, like, the urban precariat is in, like, the developing world today was the working class that we're talking about in Marx's period. But by the Second International, that's already changing, right? And that became the dominant mode of organizing. Industrial sector unions are easy to organize because you get a lot of people at a time. Several thousand per factory, you know? But even in Germany, which had the most industrial development in the beginning of the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, you never hit. They were all banking on the industrial proletariat being the majority of the population. What caused one of the causes of the first revisionist controversy where Bernstein got all weird was that didn't happen. And we've never been close to that in the United States. The United States has never been anywhere like 50% of the population is in manufacturing. Which is what I was getting at when we were talking about, like, why is the U.S. backwards? Well, even during the Fordist period, which is like the height, you know, the Fordist to the late 70s, we're not there. And then you have this public sector union growth. But the other thing is, and Gabriel Winnett talks about this pretty well, is as you're deindustrializing, all these support benefits perks that led to hospitals in these industrial areas, they're still around, and they basically become patronized as a kind of way to keep these cities from completely dying.
Uh-huh.
And so in neoliberal periods, what you have is like NGOs investing in hospitals, which are keeping like the wives of former workers employed in nursing and teaching. And like my hometown is basically, that's the only industry that's viable. Is Geico, public school, and hospitals are your church. That's it. That's all there's left. Like, you know, and it used to be people would get out through like the poverty draft, but that doesn't even exist anymore. The poverty draft was always slightly overstated, but it was real. It ended around Obama's administration because we started using drones for every goddamn thing. And we started using military contractors too. So like, there's just that that became unviable as well. We're also in a time period where the economy's bad, but unemployment is not high. And I don't even know how you get it high right now, because we are losing people from age faster than the economy shrinking.
Well, deporting millions of immigrants might do it.
How would it? I mean, that would actually make the labor market tighter.
But people aren't going to do those jobs.
Well, I mean, they do those jobs as they pay the hardship pay for them. But here's the problem. You can't pay, like, why isn't mining, which is a hardship job, a high immigrant job, right? Because mining makes enough money that they can pay out $60 an hour for the hardship. Or oil extraction in the Dakotas, stuff like that. That's effectively what farm work is. But you cannot charge those prices as a labor market and do farm work without it falling apart. Like, it's just, there's not enough profitability.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also this wild thing where we live in a time where the left has been in denial about international monetary conditions and stuff. Well, like, basically, Ingalls made fun of the American left for being stuck in monetary schemes, and like, for the last 20 years, thank you, David Graeber. But we've been stuck in even anarchists being on state level monetary schemes as their primary way of imagining how we would begin to navigate this, even though it doesn't make any sense from their own ideological perspective. I mean, but Chomsky and Graeber both did it. And it's interesting because if we really are in a moment of multipolarity and we really are back to the Truman Doctrine and we're really going to see civil service reform, what's also going to happen is that you're going to see different currency blocks develop. And while the U.S. is still relatively good, it's one of the hegemons and it's going to stay one of the hegemons. This whole MMT scheme is going to be a lot harder to do because you got to get phosphorus for the fertilizer we're running out of. And how do you get that? Well, it comes from either Morocco or China, and China needs a ton of it itself. And, you know, all these kinds of stuff start to break down. I guess this is why the communizers have their hope in crisis generating this. I just, having studied history, I don't see any evidence of that either. I don't see where crisis forces people. In fact, if anything, historically, the last 200 years, crisis has forced people into the hand of the right, not the left. Like,
but didn't you say before that unemployment is, you know, high unemployment rates would be what sort of drives a socialist movement?
It drove it in America, but high unemployment rates in Europe drove fascism.
Okay.
I mean, just that's like an unequivocal, like, you could just look at where the places where you saw the most fascist involvement were the places where inflation and unemployment were the highest. And it drove people, it drove the workers into the communist and socialist movements, actually did do that. But it drove the petite bourgeois and the associated interim classes and the non-employed working poor. So people who weren't in stable work, it drove them into the fascist in droves.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what we're seeing right now. Like, yeah, we don't have a high unemployment rate, but there's this sort of, I don't know, this ambient poverty that affects even the petty bourgeois, you know, especially after COVID, like the sense that the American dream is no longer in reach for the lower rungs of like the middle class and lower middle class. This is where Trump's made major gains, more so than like the sub working the sub middle class, which is still not voting or still majority Democrat.
Well, they were a majority Democrat. The last round of elections actually indicate they're not anymore. But the voting rates is where you'll see this really shows up.
Yeah, I mean, I think my point is we are at a time where there is something like a crisis that's not totally quantifiable economically. And the big bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie and segments of the working class that are political are seeing Trumpism as something that could be a way out of it. But the socialism never really posed itself as a solution to anything.
We were all waiting for like the crisis, and we were waiting for the riots to begin, like the endless riots that would never stop. You know, this sort of insurrectionary dream out of the 90s and after the great financial crisis. Turns out that like Trump is the crisis, right? That like what upends the whole order is political. It's not not baldly economic. Of course, there is an economic aspect to it after the great financial crisis, but like Trumpism, MAGA, the second victory especially, I think, has really, really changed the rules, changed the game.
Right.
People are saying, oh, the Democrats are dead for a generation, that this is a MAGA country now. That's not true. 49% of the people still did vote for Kamala Harris. And people said the same thing about the Republicans after Obama won in 2008. Some of us are old enough to remember that shit. But that said, there's enough delegitimation of what we can call neoliberalism, or we can call it like the consensus since the 90s, the Washington consensus, or whatever you want to call it, the Democrats, whatever. There's been enough delegitimization of that now new rules, a new regime of accumulation, maybe a new set of immigration rules, certainly a new set of labor laws, as there's now a bill in Congress to abolish OSHA, which I will not cry when OSHA goes away. Like, things are changing at a rapid pace, and maybe like a lesson that we take from Hal Draper writing in 1973 is to not imagine that we're in the same world as we were when we were writing this stuff about crisis in like the teens, you know?
Yeah. I mean, before we go ahead and the paywall, I want to talk about, I had a conversation on TAR a couple weeks ago, or a week ago, with Cuba, who was very sad about like, United States threatening to go to war with Canada, which actually Trump didn't do. Not to defend Trump, but he actually said explicitly that was the one place he wasn't going to use a military force to try to acquire. But I've been saying for a long time, like, well, the socialists, even in Europe, like Badiou, who I don't always love, but Badiou's communist hypothesis, most of that essay I think is shit. But the first part of that essay is actually kind of brilliant. Because he says the Socialist Party in France is only running off the fear of the fear. They're running off the fear of Sarkozy. And it means that your gambit is between socialists who are defending a capitalist order and right-wingers who want to change stuff and change the constitutional order. So the right wing looks to be the anti-systemic party, even though they're conservative and about restoring power, while the left wing is defending the status quo. And I'm sorry to a lot of our socialist listener friends, but dumb fuck saying stuff like FDR, Biden's the most progressive president since FDR, which A, isn't true. I'll give him maybe LBJ or Nixon, but it's not like Nixon and LBJ are both more progressive than Biden, honestly. And yes, I'm saying Nixon on purpose. But even beyond that, even if it was true, you should have never said that. Because the other thing that comes up is in the progressive vision of Biden, it was a whole lot of normalization of Trump policies, which is going to lead to some interesting things. There's going to be Trump versus Trump, where Trump is undoing things that Biden normalized during Biden's term that Trump did during his first term to do more radical things to replace it. not even necessarily because he even believes them, but because what do you do once your own policies are adopted by people that you're saying are totally reprobate?
TikTok is an example of that, right?
Right.
Trump was the one who wanted to ban TikTok. Biden comes in and is like, great idea, let's do it. And now, and Trump, you know, surges back to power with one of his big W's is saving TikTok.
And then the most pathetic reactions online, like, are people who are maybe like on the left wing of the Democratic Party or DSA or like left posters or whatever, being like, oh, the Democrats handed Trump this easy W. I can't believe they did it again. It's like, of course they did, man. Were you really expecting different? Come on.
What is Jacobin going to write about if it's not chastising the Democrats for doing Democrat stuff? Yeah. Because otherwise they're just going to be calling for us to like nationalize the dating apps again or whatever. They're beginning with that. But,
oh, right. Writing about a Nora or something like that.
Right. My point about that, though, is interesting, right? I've heard a lot of the smarter, like, center libs go, well, this is people throwing away the law at willy-nilly from the executive office, and it's going to undo the law. But I wanted to point out to them, well, Obama's not even the first to do it, but he did it extensively. Initially, DACA, and the fact that we don't have ATF and DEA raids on state marijuana farms is because Obama is also doing that by having the federal government not enforce laws. They are not like, no wonder we have a bunch of weird sex, because everyone does feel like we're being gaslit. But the socialists, you know, and I was about to say, you sounded like a Platt a second ago, but this is the Platt to write about. The socialist movement ended up seeming to be afraid of actually taking on the status quo because of the fear of the chaos it would actually unveil, despite using very radical rhetoric. Despite, you know, defund the police, which was clearly an adoption of abolish the police. But of course, you know, you don't want to talk about what abolish the police actually takes. Historically, abolish the police is you do that with socialist universal conscription into peacekeeping. Like, everybody's responsibility.
People's militia. Yeah.
Yeah. Is to do militia work. No one's going to say that. Like,
they should, but yeah, no one's. No.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I was saying it. I'm like, yeah, I'm all for abolishing the police, but it means that all of us have to do shit.
Like Switzerland, you have to have 50 rounds and a rifle in your house at all times, or else you go to jail.
But I wanted to, like, think about why all these sects are popping up again, right? Because we are seeing it. And I don't think we're just seeing it with these. I mean, I think we're seeing sectarianism in the DSA. Like, the DSA has been at civil war with itself now for 2 whole years. It's hard to know what they even think. And
like Democrats and Republicans, like this, the ACP, it seems to me that the American Communist Party, their entire thesis, their entire reason for being, was as like a schizogenesis from the DSA. Like, if the DSA are, quote, pussies, if they're like the F slur, if they get caught up with blue hair and piercings or whatever, we're going to, like the industrializers of old, wear like the flat caps, like the newsy caps, or we're going to wear boots, and we're going to say the slurs and the bad words, and we're going to be masculine and blah, blah, blah. But unlike even the 1960s or 1970s, they're not industrializing. They're not like actually going to the workers per se. They're just sort of tailing the other end of the republic of the political capitalist political spectrum, like the DSA tails the Democrats, but just tailing the Republicans instead, as though workers are magically going to like dungism if you put enough slurs in it. I don't know.
I mean, what I find funny is the super tension between like the PSL and the ACP, but it's all about culture war issues. And like, I actually would side with the PSL on most of those culture war issues, but nonetheless. Like, it's like, yeah, but like, you're not getting to the heart of the matter. None of you actually have a coherent response to the current situation, because also when you're telling us that like Khrushchev is the worst person who's ever existed, but also the crushing of the Prague and Hungarian stuff is great, which was under Khrushchev, not Stalin. And also Deng is awesome, but we needed to kill Bukharin, even though Deng is an explicit Bukharin recuperator, and actually kind of a bad one, but nonetheless he was. When people start looking this up, what are they going to believe?
Well, when we were one thing real quick, and then I'll shoot it to Andy. When I was preparing for this and thinking about this episode, I was like, what would I say that like an ACP person might find interesting or useful if they ended up listening to this? And then I realized that they never would. It's just Trotskyist jibber jabber, right? Like there's a way of just bracketing all this shit out as just like Trotskyist wrecker bullshit and never have to engage with it whatsoever. Sorry, go ahead.
But you know, and this is, I think maybe the last thing we should say before we go beyond the paywall and talk about what actually happened is this could have been, at least this like week or this month could have been ACP's moment, right? Because it feels like they were the ones who recognized that the Trump movement had more vitality, more potential than Biden and Harris. And they didn't endorse Trump, as far as I know. They're not still calling themselves MAGA communists. But their position is that the Democrats are more fascist than the Republicans. There was a huge movement.
Doug Lane in that regard.
Their real political movement over the last year. The real political movement over the last year on the left has been pro-Palestinianism, who constantly had to battle this charge that, well, if you're not supporting Biden and Harris, Trump's going to come in and he's going to be worse, which he, I think, likely still will be, or maybe not worse, but as bad.
The ceasefire.
But yeah, but this is a moment where it looks like he is better for Palestinians, at least. Because he got the ceasefire, his intervention put the ceasefire over the line. So at least in this brief moment, they could have claimed that they were right about Trump being the better force or more Bonapartist force or whatever. And yet, in this moment that could have been their victory lap, they may be disintegrating, or at least the New York chapter appears to be disintegrating, and that's what
mutual recriminations and sloppiness online is taking the place of what could be a victory lap.
Exactly,
but that shouldn't surprise us at all. What happened to all the leftists who, as soon as Biden won, the resistance got what it was. I mean, we have to forget the last 2 years, but prior to that, most of the left was happy that Biden won. Were they not? Go back and read in like New Left Review. Go back, like,
oh yeah,
Doug Henwood like doing Biden apologetics even, and Henwood's normally good on against the Democrats. Like what? Like yet they lost. And to be fair, there are other groups. Like honestly, like Chris Cotrone is going to be able to benefit a lot more from this. It's particularly if commenters in my fucking Patreon are in any indication, than the ACP is, but. Again, as this stuff moves out, I mean, as the repercussions to all these changes hit, I don't know that anybody's going to look good, right? The idea that this is that just because this is a changing moment, it's automatically going to be a good changing moment like Reagan, which also wasn't a good changing moment either, but at least was popular, is actually interesting because this is still a fairly close like society. But what we do see is liberals are the liberal impulse right now is to retreat from all public society. They are doing that. Like we're going to leave we're going to go to Blue Sky. We're going to go to Little Red Book. We're going to go to, wherever, and then they freak out about those things because they're not the perfect 2014 that they want to have again, and continue retreating from that. But what's interesting to me is I think we're not even done seeing how weird these sects are going to get. Because the other thing Andy mentioned that we haven't talked about was the 70s was a proliferation of weird religious sects and stuff, too. The new communist movement wasn't the only thing these people liquidated into.
Right.
They liquidated into all kinds of crazy shit.
Right.
I mean, that's mostly what Christopher Lasher's career was, what Gangbusters about, was describing the other crazy shit the left liquidated into after the
Back 60s. To the land, veganism, opening up co-ops in Vermont, all sorts of weird shit.
Right. I think we're going to see a lot of that again, too. But in a much, the other difference that we need to point out, and then this, then we can go behind the paywall, is that the 70s was a period of economic stagnation, but the 80s was a period of some, not a lot, economic growth for the top end. I don't see that on the horizon.
Hmm. If you notice, the rhetoric even from 8 years ago to today has changed radically among Trump. No longer are we going to see an industrial renaissance. No longer is he going to be like browbeating the capitalists to hire more workers or to keep their factories at home. Instead, it's about how much oil we're going to pump.
But it's actually closer to like Bush agenda era stuff in some ways.
Right.
But anyway, let's talk about the actual sex in the back. And
yeah, thanks everybody. Yeah.